big first year biology course, and a lecture came up on, well, there's a few lectures on evolution, and one of the lectures was on this very topic I'm talking about today, chemical evolution, which is the pre-biological phase of evolution before living systems form. They have all this chemistry that supposedly happened to form the first living organisms. And the lecturer who presented that was a highly regarded biology researcher, zoologist in Western Australia. And he made the comment during his lecture that the experiments we're talking about today drove the nails in God's coffin. And he was obviously a committed atheist. And after the lecture, there was about half a dozen of us from Evangelical Union, as it was called then, who went up and sort of engaged with him, had some questions for him. And he treated us in a pretty dismissive way. And I realised that now, looking back as someone who's been involved in research on DNA and chemistry of DNA for a long time, that professor really didn't know his stuff, and he gave a very one-sided view of this topic. So I hope today to give you guys a bit of ways of thinking about, more critically, about some of the content you might get in textbooks and basic biology courses. Okay, so just giving you something to think about. Maybe you haven't encountered these issues before, but hopefully I'll have something nevertheless that's of interest and value to you. But let's just, before we start, let's just ask our Heavenly Father to help us. Let's pray. Almighty God, we do thank you for this day, this wonderful day, and we thank you for the beauty of the surroundings here in Rawson. We thank you for the majesty of the forest, which reminds us of your creative genius. But now as we spend time thinking about the tiny, invisible aspects of your creation, we pray that you'll help us and to have attentive minds, but also that we'll give glory to you as our creator. Please be with us to that end. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay, now my apologies for the title confusion here, because Sven and I got a bit sort of mixed up, and I was right in the middle of marking thousands of exam papers, and I must have given him the wrong title. Oh, sorry, beautiful. Going to get another mic. Good man.
Do you know how to put it on?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay, so yes, the talk, I offered two talks. One on, is Christianity and science, are they friends or foes? But what I really wanted to talk about was this one today, DNA and implausibility of atheism. So somehow the title got mixed up with the description of the talk. But I'm delighted the description of the talk's in your book, because this is what we're talking about, God, DNA, and the implausibility of atheism. But you'll see, really, this other title is appropriate as well, because hopefully one of the conclusions you'll take away today is that Christian faith can actually receive sort of support from scientific study. Now, so what we're going to do firstly is, I realise some of you guys might know a lot about DNA, some of you might not know very much at all. So we'll go fairly slowly, and let's just fix up my shoelace here before I have fallen over in lectures. Happened to me once, so I won't do it today. We'll introduce DNA so you all get a bit of a feel for what this amazing molecule is. And I think it's an amazing molecule that really comes from another world, or at least it's a product of a divine intelligence. Okay, but before we do that, we're going to have to hop in a bit of a time machine here and zoom back in the past, back before I think anyone in this room was probably born. I'm probably about the oldest guy here today, but this was about 11 years before I was born, in 1953. It was a pretty big year in many ways. Some important things happened. Elizabeth was crowned Queen of England. Hillary, the New Zealander, climbed Everest, the first human to do so. We won the Davis Cup and defeated the Americans, so pretty big event in Australian history. This is in 1953, and there are also some pretty significant books that were published that in many ways have had a profound influence on shaping our modern society. But it was also a big year scientifically, because two very important or much-hailed breakthroughs were made in 1953. Now, the first one is what I'm going to focus on initially, is the discovery by Watson and Crick. So this pair of sort of an Anglo-American research collaborators, Watson was an American, James Watson, Francis Crick was a Brit. they discovered what we call the double helix structure of DNA. So this is one of the great breakthroughs in the history of science, and people knew that DNA was important in heredity, transmission from bacteria of traits from one to another. That was the work of Avery, Oswald Avery, but it was when Watson and Crick figured out how DNA performed this amazing feat that biology got one of the most profound insights, really, in its, all its history. Now, a couple of months after this work by Watson and Crick, and Watson and Crick's work didn't get a lot of attention, right? There was only people in the professional scientists who really understood the significance of what Watson and Crick did. It didn't get a lot of fanfare in the media. This other paper, which followed up a few months later by Miller and Urey, this did get a lot of fanfare. This was front page news on the Time magazine, Life magazine, newspapers all around the world. These guys performed the first experimental simulations of early Earth atmospheric conditions. Okay, and it's very interesting, though, that both of these scientific research projects, although they've been highly hailed, one has been a lot more productive of real science, in my opinion, than the other. Watson and Crick's work has led to incredible explosion of knowledge in genetics and modern molecular biology. There are probably dozens and dozens, if not hundred, perhaps 100 even, of Nobel Prizes that have gone to people that have drawn upon the basic insights from Watson and Crick. It's interesting that Miller and Urey never got a Nobel Prize for their work, and no one who's sort of worked in that area subsequently has made significant enough breakthroughs to get a Nobel Prize. And that ought to tell us something, right? This area, I'll maintain, is a bit of a dead end for science because it really tries to explain the inexplainable by leaving the creator out of the situation. Now, let's just start off with Watson and Crick, and we'll see that those two studies actually have relevance to each other, because as soon as Watson and Crick discovered the double helix of DNA, the question becomes, where did DNA come from? And the other work by Miller and Urey tried to explain that question. But let's look at Watson and Crick firstly. So this pair of researchers are very young back then, brash young American, James Watson, Francis Crick. They were postdocs. They completed their PhDs in chemistry and biochemistry, and they had this project given to them. They weren't especially high regarded by the people in their lab. People thought they were sort of slackers, didn't work hard enough. But they nevertheless had these great intellects and came up with these very profound insights into the double helix of DNA. So you can see this very simple model they came up with, and this model of the double helix of DNA showing how it forms this very tightly woven and very beautiful molecule. And we'll look at the chemical basis for that in a minute. So this is a major breakthrough because DNA, of course, is a molecule of heredity. Heredity refers to how are your mum's and dad's traits transmitted to their offspring. If you've got your dad's nose and your mum's chin or your grandma's smile, that sort of thing, genes in the form of your DNA being transmitted from one generation to the next are what is responsible. So this discovery, although we didn't necessarily know all that at the time, was the foundation for a lot of growing knowledge. Okay, so this paper was published on April the 25th in 1953 in a highly regarded journal. Within a few years, these researchers were awarded Nobel Prizes. So there we have Watson and Crick all scrubbed up in Stockholm picking up their Nobel Prize. It's, as with all great breakthroughs, the problem with Nobel Prizes is often important people get left out of the picture. And I think we now know that this lady here, Rosalind Franklin, was probably done an injustice by being left out of the Nobel Prize because she did the initial X-ray crystallography work that imaged these DNA molecules, and it was really Watson and Crick, I think, that probably drew upon her analytical data to come up with the theory that they did, and I think it's a shame that she never was included. Okay, so now, why are we talking about DNA today? And why are we talking about DNA in the context of atheism and what our basic worldview is? Well, I got interested in putting this talk together way back in 2004 when a very significant event occurred. This was a philosopher from the British Isles, Anthony Flew. Anthony Flew would be one of the most prominent atheists in the English-speaking world in sort of the World War II, post-World War II era. So for the last, 40 or 50 years, he's been a highly prominent atheist. Okay, so before there were people like Richard Dawkins, the so-called New Atheists, we had people like Anthony Flew, who probably called themselves Old Atheists perhaps, but they'd been around longer, and he was he's a philosopher who devoted his scholarly career to advancing atheism. Okay, so he rejects the existence of God. Now, but in 2004, he wrote a letter to a journal, Philosophy Today, where he had this to say. And he says, the evidential situation of natural as opposed to revealed theology has been transformed in the more than 50 years since Watson and Crick won the Nobel Prize for their discovery of the double helix structure of DNA. It has become inordinately difficult even to begin to think about constructing a naturalistic theory of the evolution of that first reproducing organism. Okay, so that's all academic jargon. He's a philosopher writing to other philosophers. What's he saying here? The evidential situation just means how much evidence is there to support my beliefs? Okay, so that's philosophers are interested in having beliefs that are well grounded in evidence and well substantiated. So he's saying the evidence supporting what he calls natural theology has been transformed by the work of Watson and Crick and their discovery of DNA. And then he goes on to say, basically, that it's really impossible to think about explaining the existence of DNA, really, without invoking a supernatural being as a creator. Okay, now what's he talking about with this natural theology? Well, basically, as Christians, we believe that God, as the creator, reveals himself to us in two broad ways. And in the Presbyterian tradition, we put a lot of emphasis on revealed theology, the special revelation in the Bible. But also, we recognise that God reveals himself through his creation and that we can obtain knowledge of the fact that there is a creator who sustains the world by looking at the beauty and the order and the regularity of the natural world. Now, of course, Anthony Flew, he spent most of his career rejecting both of these sources of revelation. But what happened as an old man, he changed his mind and he reckoned that Watson and Crick made it very difficult to sustain the atheist rejection of natural theology. So what he's basically, he didn't become a Christian, although he wrote some very nice things about Jesus and Paul towards the end of his life, so we live in hope. But he did say that he believed atheism was really undermined by the presence of DNA and as such a marvellous molecule. So he's now accepting that a God exists who had something to do with the origin of life. He's giving a tick to natural theology. So he hasn't accepted the Bible as the word of God yet. He's not a Christian, but he's accepting some sort of theism and the idea that the world we inhabit is a product of a divine mind. Okay, so that's Anthony Flew. Now, basically, what I want to do in the remainder of this talk is just give you some reasons for why I agree with Anthony Flew and why I think he's really just stating the obvious, because it's very difficult to explain where this amazing molecule DNA came from without invoking the intervention of a creator. Okay, so what are the two questions we want to talk about? Well, firstly, we just want to address this basic question to make sure we're all up to speed on what DNA is and what it's made of and what its shape is and how it functions. And then the main thrust of the talk is to address this question of where DNA came from and to ask specifically whether scientific naturalism, that is an atheistic science that leaves God out of the picture, whether that can explain the origin and appearance of DNA. Okay, so what is DNA? I'm sure we hear about it almost every day in the media. There'll be all sorts of stories in the newspaper and on internet websites. You're probably familiar with these. We're familiar with DNA being used to convict murderers or rapists who committed a heinous crime and left traces of their DNA behind at the crime scene or on the victim. Or we might hear of movie stars or rock stars disputing paternity claims when a woman comes up and says, well, that's my child, you're here, you are the father of my child. And when they want to know whether that's true or not, they can analyse the DNA of the offspring and compare it to the father to work out whether established paternity. Or more commonly, perhaps, we hear about medical breakthroughs where a gene that's mutated in particular people has been implicated in causing cancer. So DNA has all sorts of applications in the modern world. But what is it? Do we ever stop to think about what this molecule is? Well, of course, DNA stands for deoxyribose nucleic acid, so it's an acronym. And it's really just a complex chemical stuff that stores information in all living organisms. So it doesn't matter whether we're talking about enormous organisms like blue whales or elephants, or tiny ones like spiders and beetles, or whether we're talking about very aggressive carnivores like lions and bears, or very peaceful, placid butterflies. All living organisms depend on DNA to make copies of themselves when they reproduce, but also to carry out their normal existence. Okay, so in humans, DNA obviously is essential in constructing a new body during the process of reproduction and the growth of that body during human development. And essentially, DNA is a polymer or an agglomerate containing carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and phosphorus atoms. So just five elements, or different types of atoms made of different elements, contribute to the structure of this amazing molecule. And what it essentially does is it acts as a blueprint during cell doubling. Okay, and the word blueprint, perhaps it doesn't make so much sense in today's information era because we don't use blueprints the way we used to, but in the old days when we used to make things in a factory, the people who did the manufacturing would refer to blueprints which defined in very tiny detail, exacting detail, how a new product, a new car or a new motorbike was going to be constructed in that factory. So that's what the DNA does. Every time the cell reproduces itself, it interrogates its DNA in order to make copies of all the different components that are present within a living cell. And there's a lot of cells in the human body, around some 10 to the 13 power, so that's 10 followed by 13 zeros. And when you think of how much DNA is just in one cell, if you took all the DNA out of the nucleus and stretched it out, it's longer than your arm span. It's about 2 metres in length. So if you took all the DNA from all the 10 to the 13 cells and stretched it all out, people say you could get to the sun in terms of all the DNA in just a single adult human. So there's an enormous amount of DNA in the human body. In terms of the information content, it's about three or four volumes, I think, of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And again, that's something you probably don't know about because Britannica's gone digital in recent years. But they used to publish these big, heavy, dense books with small writing, and they contain an enormous amount of information. So there's as much information in a tiny human cell in the nucleus, in the DNA, as in several very substantial volumes of Encyclopedia Britannica. And most of that 2 metres of DNA is wound up and stored in a remarkable way in the nucleus through in the form of chromosomes, and it's wound very tightly around histones and to form chromatin, and this allows that long piece of DNA to be compacted in a very tiny organism, tiny entity. Okay, now, so the DNA tells a cell how to make copies of itself, and not only the nucleus, but all these internal components of the cell, the endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi apparatus, the mitochondria, lysosomes, the cytoplasmic content, the ribosomes, the little blue dots where all the protein manufacturing occurs. The template for the construction of all these tiny entities, as well as the thousands upon thousands of proteins that carry out all the functions in these tiny little entities, is all encoded within the genetic material. Now, but how does DNA do that? Well, it does it because it's a polymer. Okay, so a polymer, of course, I'm sure you're all familiar with. You're all probably wearing polymers around our necks, aren't we? This plastic band is a polymer of some kind. You've probably got polymers in your shoes or other parts of your clothing. Polymer is a molecule, a great long molecule, that's formed by fusing repeating units of what we call monomers. Okay, so one of the good examples we'll refer to here is polyvinyl chloride. PVC is one of the highest production chemicals in the world, and it's very useful for making all sorts of things, ranging from raincoats, electrical tape or gloves, or you can add hardeners to it and make piping for use in plumbing and all sorts of applications. So now, PVC is just a single, made from a single monomer, vinyl chloride, and it fuses to form these great long chains of polyvinyl chloride. Okay, so it can be a very useful molecule for making stuff that's bendable and flexible and also resists water. But PVC has no information storing content. It's really, in a sense, it's a dumb polymer because it's just a single repeating unit, and it really can't store information in any way. But DNA is different because we might call PVC a homopolymer. In a homopolymer, all of the monomers are identical. But in the case of a heteropolymer, such as DNA, each of these monomers may be different. Okay, so in this example here, it's not DNA, but we've got monomer A, B, and C, and we're repeating them in a chain and storing information basically in a linear form in chemical code. So this is an amazing property that DNA has. So we can store enormous quantities of genetic information and biological information in these chain-like strands of DNA just by varying the arrangement of the monomeric species within the DNA. So just in the same way that the English language, 26 letters can be used to construct vast books, the Bible ranging from encyclopedias and all the daily newspaper, just by varying how we arrange those letters, in the same way we can construct a whole organism just by varying the sequence of bases and monomers in DNA. Okay, so in the case of DNA, there are four polymers, and you probably know these codes already, A, G, C, and T. The A stands for deoxyadenosine, the G for deoxyguanosine, the C for deoxycytidine, and the T for deoxythymidine. So by varying these four letters through the in terms of their sequence within a strand of DNA, that allows us to store information in genes that tell what the developing organism, what colour hair you have and how strong you are, and all sorts of different properties based on your genetic code. So in many ways, we now think of the human body in as a sort of a digital construct. It's quite a remarkable reality, actually, because I'm sure you're all familiar with binary code. Binary code is what allows computer chips to process electronic information, and in your mobile phones, they're constantly churning through code and software, all based on binary code. So binary code is based on the use of either a 0 or a 1 at each point in the sequence. Okay, so we can store all that genetic information on different sort of devices and use them to run or input into computer programs. So that's how a digital system works. It stores information that's coded by programmers and then used when we want that software to do something we like, play a game or do some work for us. Now, in the same way, the human body is a digital entity. But in this case, rather than binary code, a 0 or a 1, we've actually got a quaternary code with an A, G, T or C. And this allows a vast amount of information to be stored in a DNA strand. Okay, so we can think of, in many ways, the body as representing an expression of this basic digital nature of information storage within our genetic materials. And this is a pretty amazing concept, really. And in fact, it's remarkable, because when you think of how recent our computer technology is, it's only about the last 50 or 60 years, I think, since we've appreciated how to design computers and use binary code to get computers to do work for us. And around the same time, we made this stunning discovery that humans are also digital creatures, except that the information is stored in quaternary code. And so it's amazing. We probably couldn't have made the discoveries in biology that we have made in the last 40 years or so without having the same capability to understand digital systems in computer science. So it's one of the amazing congruences. We're living in a remarkable period in history where we've gained some amazing insight into what the human body is made of and how it works. Now, let's dig down a little bit more to see what this DNA molecule is really like. Well, I've said it's a heteropolymer, that is, that each of those monomeric species in a strand of DNA can vary with one of those four options, adenine, guanine, or adenosine, guanosine, thymidine, or cytosine. But when we look at the structure of those monomers, they're also complex. Okay, so unlike that polyvinyl chloride, the PVC we were talking about, where it's the same simple little monomer just being repeated endlessly, in the case of DNA, the monomers are quite complex. So they contain three basic features: a phosphate, a sugar group, and a base. And they all need to be attached in this particular configuration in order for this monomer to have the right structure in order to be able to insert itself, be inserted into DNA. Okay, and then the other three have the same sort of structure. Adenosine here, deoxyadenosine, that contains a base, adenine attached to the same sugar and a phosphate group. Deoxycytidine contains cytosine here, the green molecule, and deoxythymidine, the yellow thymidine, is thymidine. And you'll see there's a couple of features here. These two, A and G, are what we call purines. They contain two ring structures fused to each other. These guys here are pyrimidines. They contain a single six-membered ring. And this is important, and Watson and Crick figured this out, that within that tight strand of the double helix of DNA, we can accommodate a purine and a base and a pyrimidine all the way down in that, like a stack of pancakes in the double helix. Okay, so we couldn't accommodate two purines or two pyrimidines. It doesn't work that way. It's a guanine with a cytosine or an adenine with a thymidine. Now, so it gets more complex. When the molecule is being formed, a molecule of DNA is being formed, we get the linking between these adjacent monomeric species to get the polymer to form. And that all occurs through the sugar phosphate backbone. So we get a sugar group, deoxyribose attached to phosphate, to a sugar, to a phosphate, to a sugar, to a phosphate, and so on. And then the information is stored according to which of the bases, adenine, thymidine, cytosine, or guanine, that's attached to the sugar phosphate backbone. So by varying that sequence, we can determine the function of the DNA and the gene as to what develops during development. Okay, so this is just making that point I referred to. The great discovery of Watson and Crick was this double helix structure, where these two strands of DNA are said to be complementary in the sense that they contain these monomeric species that bind to each other very specifically and accommodate each other within this very beautiful double helix structure. And this is it's a remarkably beautiful molecule. If you ever get the chance to see a big model of a DNA molecule, some of them are as big as a human being, and just to spend time looking at them and work out where all the bonds are and where all the bases are, it's truly a beautiful molecule and a remarkable one. Now, I've already been talking about genes. What are genes? Well, genes are runs of hundreds or thousands of those monomer species. On average, a human gene has about 3,000 monomers within a typical human gene. And these are all right down in the level of the double helix, and then all that DNA is compacted in the form of chromosomes and folded very tightly. to allow accommodate all that 2 meters of DNA to be wound right down into a tiny nucleus. Okay, so genes are very important things. They control our hair color and skin color, eye color. They govern the development of an unborn baby, growth of limbs and the nervous system. All that stuff is under the control of genes, a beautifully orchestrated process. Genes also influence how tall we get, whether we're big or thin, our personality, our intelligence, athletic ability, all sorts of things are influenced by our genetic complement. Now, when I was taught biology as a young man, it was always emphasised that a lot of the DNA in cells doesn't actually make protein. So the main function of that I was taught of DNA was this process, the so-called central dogma of biology, whereby these genes within a run of DNA are transcribed to make an RNA template, and this gives these mRNA or message RNA, which is then translated to make protein at the ribosomes. And I'm sure you've all learnt about that in your high school biology. Now, the interesting thing is that we've known for a long time that the genes that actually make proteins are actually a fairly small proportion of DNA. It's about 3 or 4% of the total human genome is actually used to make proteins. And that raises the question of what's all the rest of that stuff doing? And when I was a boy, we were told that it was a leftover from evolution and that we used to call it junk DNA. We thought it was just serving no practical function. But we now know that that's really not true, because some researchers have done some pretty remarkable studies where you can make mice where you chop out all the non-coding stuff and just retain the coding, protein-making red bits of DNA. And those animals are very sick. They don't survive prenatally. They die within the womb. So this non-coding DNA, which we thought was junk for a long time, actually has all sorts of functions in controlling which genes are switched on and off at which time as a new body develops and progresses and matures. So a lot of those early ideas we were taught haven't held up, the idea that there's this, all this junk left over from evolution. Now, just another term to be familiar with too, you might have heard of the Human Genome Project. This is a capability that emerged in about the late decade of the 20th century, when it became obvious that we had high-speed computers and high-speed DNA analysis apparatus, robots to do a lot of the manual work for us. People began dreaming of being able to analyse or sequence the entire human genome, that is all those 23 chromosomes, to work out the sequence of monomers in an individual. And that's a vast amount of information present in each human. And so this is a Human Genome Project, and the first draft of the Human Genome Project was completed over a decade ago now, and you can see the front page of Time magazine there. And two people were in charge of this project were Craig Venter and Francis Collins. Some of you might know Francis Collins because he's an evangelical Christian and he's written a few books on different aspects of the Christian faith. But he was one of the driver of the so-called public initiative. He's from the National Institutes of Health in Washington. And so he was cooperating with Venter back at that time anyway to come up with the first draft of the human genome. Francis Collins said this in 2001 when the first draft of the human genome was published. And I think one of the American presidents, I think it was President Clinton, was standing next to him. And he said, "It's humbling for me and awe-inspiring to realise that we've caught the first glimpse of our own instruction book, previously known only to God." And that is amazing, isn't it? That we're the first, you know, generation really that's had this remarkable insight into the material basis for what goes into making a human body. Now, another thing you should be familiar with too is that the cost of doing that sequencing back in those days, 15 years ago, that was a very expensive undertaking, a massive global effort. There were laboratories all around the world doing little bits of each chromosome and then assembling the data in the US. Now, all this can be done much more quickly with a thing called a next-gen sequencer. And these are amazing devices, and they're pretty well present everywhere now in throughout the Western world. And I've got that picture there. Ozzy Osbourne was one of the first people, I think, to pay to get his genome sequenced. And you can do that now. The cost has dropped dramatically. But the cost of actually analysing all the data in your genome is a very different matter. It, and that's one of the areas, I think, that's coming out of this field is how do we use this technology? This technology has great power to do a lot of good, but it also, in the hands of the wrong people, can do evil, in my view. And so, in some cases, we're just using this technology to identify so-called imperfect humanity within the womb and exterminate them. And that, to me, is a really unfortunate development, I think, in modern medicine. We can do enormous good with these machines because we can use them to work out what's wrong in a particular individual's tissue. They suffer from a disease that affects their heart or their brain, for example. And then we can do medical research to try and fix that defect. But unfortunately, people with a low view of the human race are using that information just to weed out humanity within the womb. And I think that's a really unfortunate development. But that's not what we're talking about today. Now, so that's what, hopefully you know a little bit about DNA, what it is, and how it's having a profound impact on modern society, this ability to manipulate DNA and to sequence it, to take genes from one organism and put them in another. All that synthetic biology is very much a routine capability now. So we're living in a remarkable time. But one question that never really gets addressed is where does DNA come from? And this is a fascinating question. Where does this amazing molecule with this staggering ability to store very dense biological information in this beautiful double helix structure, where did it come from? And so to answer the question, we really have to draw upon our most basic belief systems in order to answer that question. And we might call these presuppositions. It's something we talk about a lot in the Christian faith, particularly in Reformed theology. We talk about the presuppositions on which humans base their beliefs and their worldview, their lifestyle. The basic beliefs we hold regarding reality come into play when we try to answer this question. And of course, the prevailing worldview in our society in the Western world at the present, and has been for the last 150 years or so, of course, is the naturalistic worldview. And I've got this famous quotation here from Carl Sagan, who probably many of you won't know, but he was very influential when I was a young man as a spokesman for science. He did a pretty good TV show called Cosmos that looked at the history of science. But right at the beginning of that show, he had this almost like a creed, a confession of faith. You know how in the Presbyterian Church we sometimes read the Apostles' Creed, this is what we believe, I believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth. We do that as part of our worship. Well, Carl Sagan, his creed, he stated at the beginning, right at the beginning of his show, was the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. Okay, so it's very committed atheism. There's no role for a God in this worldview. All we have is this hard physical reality, nuts and bolts, matter, molecules, and nothing beyond it. No divine being, and certainly no divine being that interacts with the cosmos. Now, how does this affect our ability to answer that question if we hold to this naturalistic view? Well, I've got this quotation here from Richard Dickerson, who's a very accomplished biochemist. He did some very pioneering work in the 1960s at the UCLA looking at the structure of a molecule called hemoglobin, which carries oxygen around the body. But he also has proven himself a very committed atheist. And he made this staggering observation about 15 years ago. He says, science fundamentally is a game. It's a game with one overriding and defining rule. Rule number one in science, according to Professor Dickerson, let's see how far and to what extent we can explain the behaviour of the physical and material universe in terms of purely physical and material causes without invoking the natural, the supernatural. Okay, see what he's saying? And it's sort of news to me that science is a game. I thought it was a pretty serious undertaking. But he thinks it's a game to try and have fun explaining the world without invoking the existence of a creator and a supernatural being. So this is how he thinks about science. So if you're going to ask him where did DNA come from, someone who holds to this worldview is going to try to explain the origin of DNA without mentioning a God as being involved in the origin. Okay, so how does this mentality, we call this naturalistic because it recognises the existence only of natural, physical, observable structures, and it rejects the existence of an unseen God. Well, they come up with this theory called, we might call it abiogenesis. They believe that DNA and the other complex molecules required to sustain life were produced on the early Earth by random, unplanned, natural processes. Okay, so God had nothing to do with the design of this magnificent double helix. It came about through random, naturalistic processes that just happened in an environment with no input at all from an external mind. Now, this is an idea that's been around for some time, and Charles Darwin himself was one of the first people to advocate this idea that life might have arisen on Earth without the input of a creator. And you've probably heard of this quotation before, perhaps it's quite famous, but he invoked this warm little pond. He imagined that there might have been some little pond in the early Earth, perhaps, where this was a cradle of life, where all these chemical reactions came together and gave rise to these the molecules that make up living organisms. Okay, so this is what he said. He wrote it in a letter to a friend in 1871. "But if, and oh, what a big if, we could conceive of some warm little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, light, heat, electricity, etc. present, that a protein compound was chemically formed." Okay, so bear in mind, he's writing in 1871. No one had discovered DNA. We didn't know DNA existed then. Certainly didn't know what it was made of. He's talking about proteins because he did know about proteins. They had been discovered. But if we could plug in DNA there, really, that would get us to what this naturalistic mind thinks, that it basically believes in some little warm pond or some natural structure was the cradle of life. Now, one of the first people to start advancing this idea scientifically was a Russian scientist, Alexander Oparin. And he published a very influential book in 1924 called The Origin of Life. Now, you've got to be aware of the context in which he did his work. He was a committed Soviet communist. This is in the communist era in Russia. Russia had gone through this very violent, tumultuous revolution. They wanted to pull down the influence of the Russian Orthodox Church, get rid of all that thousand years of Christianity, and replace the Christian creation narrative with an atheist version of how life came about. So that's what he did in this book. And he proposed that the beginnings of life came about from reactions between various gases in the early atmosphere of the Earth. Primitive Earth, methane, ammonia, hydrogen and water were the gases he suggested. And this is partly because these gases had been discovered on planetary bodies by astronomers. And so he proposed that perhaps some of those planetary bodies, the methane and ammonia-rich environment might have also prevailed on planet Earth. Now, okay, so according to this idea, these so-called primordial gases on the early Earth, such as ammonia, methane, hydrogen gas, water vapour, with the input of appropriate energy, gave rise to these various monomers, these building blocks that are required for the assembly of complex molecules like DNA. So in the case of DNA, we're referring to sugars and bases, but also they believe proteins originated via this sort of mechanism as well. Now, in addition to the reactions occurring within the atmosphere, scientists also believe that meteorites may have seeded life on our planet by bringing in some of these molecules from elsewhere in the galaxy, because some of these monomers have been found on meteorites. But then they believe that these monomers, through the input of further energy, began polymerising, began forming these complex macromolecules, these big molecules that make up living organisms. Things like DNA and RNA are the ones we're focusing on, or DNA today. And then via ongoing processes, random natural processes, early living cells formed in after these sort of membrane-bound globules of fat really started internalizing some of these primitive molecules, and we began getting early living cells. And so this is all a precursor to the Darwinian phase of evolution that we're all taught about, where single cells became more complex and developed to give rise to us. But what we're doing today is focusing on the so-called pre-biological phase of evolution. Okay, so no matter what you think about Darwinism, the prebiotic phase, before the emergence of a living organism, is something we can actually test in the laboratory. We can run simulations and work out how plausible are all these various steps. Okay, so that's what that other second paper that I highlighted, published in 1953, that's why this is such a significant study. Because Stanley Miller was then a very young guy. He was 23 years of age. He was studying at the University of Chicago in the United States. And he read an English translation of Alexander Oparin's book on the origin of life. And he got all excited by it. He thought, oh, great, this is going to prove my atheism, basically. We can explain the emergence of life without a creator. But let's prove this experimentally. So with his supervisor, Urey, so these are sometimes called the Miller-Urey experiments, he set up this glass sphere and he filled it with gases that Oparin suggested prevailed on the early Earth, and they began sparking it, trying to simulate electrical storms and lightning bolts on the early Earth, and he waited to find out what formed. Okay, so let's have a look at his experiment in a little more detail. He took this apparatus, which was this glass sphere here, which he filled up with gases, methane, ammonia, water, and hydrogen, and had this bubbling bath here, filled with water, making vapor that was sort of making its way through the reaction chamber. And the input of energy in the form of sparks was used to simulate lightning on the early Earth, and this water, as it washed its way or made its way through the reaction chamber, it picked up some of the chemical products and returned them to the water environment. And after a week of this experiment running, Stanley Miller stopped the reaction, took a sample out, analysed it to see if there's anything in there, couldn't find anything, played around with the system a bit to increase the energy input, put it back together and ran it for another week. And the second time when he analysed the mixture in the water there, he found some amino acids, very simple, the two most basic amino acids, alanine and glycine, and he got very excited. Now, he didn't find any evidence for DNA in there, and this is what we're going to talk about, but this was the first demonstration that reactions between simple gases that are imagined to have prevailed on the early Earth could make things like amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. So they thought, oh, well, if we can make proteins, surely we can make DNA as well from their building blocks. Okay, so that's the Miller-Urey experiment. Let's just have a look at what these sorts of experiments have revealed. And we're going to find out that it's actually very hard to make DNA under these sorts of Miller-Urey type models. And hopefully I'll convince you that Anthony Flew, this philosopher who changed his mind from atheism to some sort of theism, on the basis of the difficulty in explaining the existence of DNA, actually had a pretty valid point and is probably ahead of a lot of scientists in understanding the inadequacies of scientific naturalism to explain life. Now, what have we found from doing these experiments? Now, let's just go back to this system here. Scientists being scientists, when we read each other's work, we often think, oh, I don't like the way they did that bit of the experiment. I'd like to use something different, use a higher concentration of a drug or whatever in my context. But whatever experiment they do, you always find holes in it. And so people have repeated Miller's work thousands of times and they've done things differently. And in particular, they've varied the gases they put in the chamber up here. Some people think that Miller's work was much too reducing. That is, it shouldn't have all that ammonia in there and all that hydrogen and all that methane. And so they've put different gases in there because they believe the early Earth had a different gaseous environment or atmosphere than Miller did. Other things I've done is replace the water in some cases and heat sources. They've varied the different electrical sources. Some people have put sort of hot volcanic rocks in there in the belief that life might have emerged in hot volcanic vents. Others have done it in hot, salty water in the belief that life might have emerged in geothermal vents deep in the ocean. All sorts of different variations on Miller's experiments have been done. But they all basically follow this idea that these reactions between these very small gases built up these much more complex molecules and gave rise to amazing molecules like DNA. Now, so what are some of the findings that have come from these early Earth simulations? Well, the most obvious observation is really the fact you get lots of brown goo. This is sort of a bit of a picture here trying to make that point, but when they run these experiments, because of the random nature of the chemistry occurring, a lot of the chemistry involves just making these useless, big, long, brown, gooey, sticky molecules, and they just stick to the apparatus of the glass. Now, this is really just unavoidable, just due to the fact that you're putting all this energy into this mixture of very simple gases. You're going to get all sorts of random chemistry occurring, and one of which is just to make this brown goo. So it's mainly due to these reactions between methane. It starts forming these great big long polymers that really have no relevance at all to living systems. They have no biological significance. They're not reproducing anything intelligible within a living system. Okay, so really what you get from these experiments is a highly complex chemical soup. And there's so many, the more our analytical techniques have developed in the last few decades, the more detailed have our descriptions of these chemical soup have become. There are thousands of molecules present in the chemical soup, but mixed in with all this brown junk. Now, what about the more positive aspects of this research? Well, giving credit to the researchers who have done this research, they have done early Earth simulations where you can come up with most of the four bases. Now, I say most of them because cytosine is a very hard one to make with gases, and they use other sorts of chemical reagents that have very questionable relevance to the early Earth. But some people believe that the methods they use to create cytosine have been verified. Okay, so yes, we'll give it with a bit of a half-hearted tick. We'll concede that yes, guanine, adenine, cytosine, thymidine have been formed under so-called so early Earth simulations. Sugars are much harder to make under early Earth simulations, and really, 2-deoxyribose, a constituent of DNA, has never really been properly described under early Earth simulations. But one of the important points to make here is that getting even those four bases, adenine, guanine, thymine and cytosine, has a lot to do with what gases you put in the flask. So let's look at these molecules in a little more detail. We said water's in there. This is one of the aspects of Miller's and Urey's model. They pump steam through their reaction apparatus. So water, of course, contains an oxygen atom and a couple of hydrogens. So we can think of water as bringing an oxygen molecule into whatever's randomly forming within our reaction. Methane, very simple hydrocarbon, just one carbon atom bonded to four hydrogens. We can think of that as bringing carbon to the reactions. And then hydrogen gas is a hydrogen donor. Other people have used carbon dioxide in the belief that there might have been carbon dioxide on the early Earth. So this is going to donate oxygen, carbon. And then ammonia was the other reagent that Miller included in his experiment. So ammonia is just nitrogen bonded to three hydrogens. So it's a nitrogen donor. Now, why does this matter? Well, each of these molecules are just like simple little Lego blocks that are going to start being randomly assembled together in the hope that we're going to get meaningful molecules being made. But it's all got to do with which gases you put in the flask as to which bases form. So let's have a look at three of these bases. They've got something in common. Guanine, thymidine and cytosine. And I'm sorry I've resorted to some real chemical structures here. It's the only time we'll probably do it, I think. But I've colour-coded them here. You can see I've colour-coded all the nitrogens red, the carbons green and the oxygen blue. Okay, so these three bases, guanine, thymidine and cytosine, contain carbon, hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen. Adenine, on the other hand, just as essential to the function of DNA, doesn't contain any oxygen. So it's got carbons, nitrogens only and hydrogens. No oxygen. Sugars, on the other hand, are carbohydrates. So they contain carbon, hydrogen and oxygen. But they contain no oxygen. Okay, can you see the problem here? If we're just going to randomly assemble all these molecules from one carbon molecules or one nitrogen molecules like ammonia or one carbon molecules like methane, then if we want to make something like adenine, it doesn't have any oxygen in it, we have to leave these oxygen donor molecules out of the flask. Whereas if, on the other hand, we want to make sugars, we have to leave all the nitrogen out of the molecule, out of the flask. So you can see how the experimentalists are tweaking their system based on what they want to make, whether they want to make a sugar or a base, rather than choosing an objective reaction condition and going with it. Okay, because that's the whole point. I mean, the air we breathe in Melbourne and the air we breathe in Perth is the same. The air we breathe in Africa or North America all contains the same fixed concentration of oxygen and nitrogen. So how could it be that we would have local environments on the early Earth where there is ammonia present in some environments to make some of the bases, but not present in other environments to make the sugars or the other components? Okay, so you see that big problem? It's a really big problem. So the gases you put inside your chamber dictate what you make during these sorts of milliurae experiments. And that's a pretty inappropriate thing to do. It's called investigator interference, when you're prejudging the type of molecules you want to make rather than and choosing the gases you put in your vessel rather than doing so objectively based on what you think the early Earth atmosphere comprised. Now, okay, so that's as good as it gets, really. Yes, they can make each of the four bases with the proviso that they do so not under the same experimental conditions. You have to leave ammonia out if you want to make some of the sugars, for example. You have to leave oxygen out or an oxygen donor out if you want to make adenine. But what about the next question? Remember that we said DNA is a complex heteropolymer, and each of these bases needs to be attached in a very precise way to the sugar and to the phosphate. So these, when they form these little triplicate sort of entities, we call them deoxynucleotides. These deoxynucleotides have rarely, if ever been detected under early Earth experiments. Okay? Never been detected. You just get such trivial yields because the combination between the base, the sugar, and the phosphate is very, very unlikely. And so because the deoxynucleotides don't form, then that means DNA will rarely form as well. Okay, so we rarely, if ever, get properly formed DNA with a proper sugar phosphate backbone with bases attached to the sugar molecule. Just doesn't happen under these sorts of milliurae experiments. Okay, so let's summarise those key findings. Yes, we'll be generous and charitable to our colleagues who are atheists and say, yes, if you are willing to tweak experimental conditions by leaving gases in or putting one in or taking it out, yes, you can form often small quantities, but you can form most of these five components of DNA. But rarely, if ever, do we see the next step occurring, the formation of the deoxynucleotides or the next step after that, the formation of the DNA molecule itself. Now, why is that? So I just want to look at some of the reasons for why these experiments fail to make DNA And I think they'll make sense to you. And these are things you'll be able to remember perhaps when you encounter this sort of content at school. Okay, so just to summarise, the Miller-Urey model, going back to Alexander Oparin and even back to Charles Darwin, is that the primordial gases with the input of energy created these monomeric building blocks, including sugars and bases, and yes, some of the bases form, sugars not so much, but certainly there's no real evidence, convincing evidence, that any of these sort of Miller-Urey type experimental models can proceed to them, make anything like an intact DNA molecule. It just doesn't happen under these sorts of experimental conditions. Now, why is these experiments so difficult? I just want to give you five or six basic reasons for why these experiments fail to produce DNA. And we're going to use a simple analogy here so that you can all remember, hopefully. We're going to use the idea of a chef cooking away in their kitchen, making some magnificent food or plate product. And you see, what the atheist position asks us to believe is that a kitchen can produce a fabulous molecule like DNA without any chef present. That's basically the idea I'm trying to get across to you. And we'll see what it means to have no chef in the kitchen in the early Earth, so to speak, what that means for the origin of life. Now, one of the reasons why these early Earth simulations produce little or no DNA is just due to the sheer complexity of the chemical soup. And so one reason why monomers and polymers can't properly assemble is because of side reactions that arise from the sheer complexity of the chemical soup. Now, the chemical soup problem just refers to the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, one of the major products of these sorts of reactions are these great long brown polymeric molecules that just coat the glass of all the experimental apparatus, and all sorts of junk forms in your experimental model. But a lot of the products that are being formed are completely useless to the structure of DNA. And so, yes, we do have technology that allows us to go in there and find, yes, we do, we might get small quantities of guanine formed in our complex soup or thymidine. The reality is there's all this other junk in there as well. And one of the things you learn in chemistry is that if we want to make complex molecules, it's really important to start with pure, clean reagents so that we can control the chemistry to go in certain directions. The last thing you want is thousands upon thousands of impurities floating around in your reaction vessel, because that will carry out all sorts of unwanted and useless side reactions. So that, to bring that down to earth, while we want our systems to produce some of these deoxynucleotides, which are highly ordered configurations, in reality, probably what we get is just a lot of junk. And so any of these molecules might react with each other. We get all sorts of junk being formed. And the probability of a thymine reacting with a sugar or an adenine reacting with a sugar is drastically reduced due to the fact that there's so much junk as a result of using this very uncontrolled synthetic arrangement. We're using just gases as our starting material. Okay, so how can we use bring this analogy down to daily life? Well, imagine if you're going to Woolies and you decided you've got friends coming over and you want to make a chicken soup for your friends. And you went into Woolies and you took a big trolley and you just put every ingredient on all the aisles in Woolies into your shopping trolley and then took them home and put them in a great big pot and mixed it all up. Now, you could say technically, yes, there probably is some chicken seasoning in there. There's probably some chicken stock because you did happen to grab some off those right aisles. But what about all the other junk that's in there, the cornflakes and the milk products and the pineapple juice and all the other stuff you've got? You see, that's the problem. There's no intelligence going down the aisle and saying, yes, I need the chicken, I need the stock or whatever. There's no intelligence guiding the selection of ingredients. And so successful outcomes in the kitchen require careful selection of the right ingredients. And we know this from daily life, but for some reason we forget this when we start thinking about worldviews, because our worldviews blind us to that basic reality. So that's our first reason why I think atheism is implausible. There's no pre-existent supernatural being with the brains to choose the right ingredients for the chemical soup needed to make DNA. So we're cooking in a kitchen without a chef, and that's there's no intelligence inputting into our system. Now, another problem is due to the fact that we are living on an environment, in a planet that's very rich in water. What is it? 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by water. And so it's very hard to get rid of water when you're doing these early Earth simulations. And this is bad news to a chemist, because one of the things you learn in organic chemistry is if you want to build big molecules, you normally have to avoid having water present, because water inhibits all the linking steps that are needed to build those beautiful, long, complex polymer chains in DNA. So let's look at this just in a little more detail. Remember I said each deoxynucleotide contains a base, such as adenine, attached very precisely to a five-membered sugar, deoxyribose, and then with a phosphate group attached in a very defined position. Now, each of the time when we get the formation of a deoxynucleotide, when the adenine comes in and reacts, or when the phosphate comes in and reacts and attaches to the sugar, each of those reactions involves the release of a water molecule. We call this a dehydration or a condensation step in chemistry. So water is being released as a product of the linking between the phosphate and the sugar and the base, or the adenine and the sugar. And where does the water come from? Well, we often use the term in chemistry, cowboy chemistry. My chemistry professor would, when he was building molecules on the blackboard back in those days, we didn't have PowerPoint, he'd say, "Let's do some cowboy chemistry, boys." And he'd get a piece of chalk and he would draw a big lasso around a hydrogen and a hydroxyl group on two adjacent molecules, because they're going to come together and expel water from the reaction. Okay? So I've color-coded them here. The hydrogen and the oxygen come from one of the molecules, one of the participants in the linking reaction. The hydrogen in purple comes from the adenine. Okay? So these are water-producing reactions. And it's a basic rule in chemistry that you never do a reaction in a solvent that's the same as the reaction product of that reaction. Does anyone remember Le Chatelier's principle? You probably learned that in year 10 chemistry. In fact, if you sit a deoxynucleotide in water, it will spontaneously hydrolyze or break down and split into those two constituents. So water reverses the sort of linking chemistry we need to assemble a deoxynucleotide. So this is bad news if you're trying to build a molecule in the presence of water, because there's water swimming around everywhere and the adenine simply won't fuse to the sugar because of the presence of the reaction product all around the molecule, and the same won't happen with the phosphate. So that's one reason why we don't see deoxynucleotides forming under these sort of Miller-Urey experiments. Now this problem, now you see why we don't get any DNA formed. It's because dehydration, or elimination of water, occurs every time we link a base to a sugar and every time we link a sugar to a phosphate. All the way, all these bonds through here are condensation or dehydration reactions. They're just not going to happen if there's a sniff of moisture around, a sniff of water. Got a good quote here from one of the great books on origins. It's a couple of decades old now, but if you can get a copy of this book, he's not a Christian. He's a Jew. I think he may be a sort of atheist-leaning Jew, but he wrote this brilliant book, a chemist, Origins, A Skeptic's Guide to the Creation of Life on Earth. But he says this: the formation of water in an environment that is full of it is a chemical equivalent of bringing sand to the Sahara. In fact, the reverse reactions are the ones that occur spontaneously. Water happily attacks large biological molecules. It pries nucleotides apart from each other, breaks sugar to phosphate bonds, and severs bases from sugars. Okay, so you see how water is a problem in blocking the chemistry that's needed to assemble a complex molecule such as DNA. And if you go on and do chemistry at university and learn how to build complex molecules, one of the first things they teach you in chemistry labs is to use something like a calcium chloride drying tube, which has a way of any reaction that produces water the water gets trapped in your drying tube and it allows the chemistry, the linking, to start keep happening in your vessel. And we even know this on a daily basis. If you work in a lab where you make your own DNA, you can, these DNA synthesis machines, you attach a bottle of like C, G, A or T, stick it on the DNA synthesizer. It's very important that you keep those bottles of reagents in a thing called a desiccator. And it's got all this silica gel, you know, the stuff you get, the little bags of silica gel in your new mobile phone to keep all the electronics dry. Well, we use it in laboratories to keep our chemical reagents dry. And you put the lid on it, suck the air out, have it in a vacuum, and you have a desiccant there. And it stops all the water getting into your reagents. And it just means that your DNA manufacturing, your synthesis occurs a lot better if you don't have any moisture around. Another thing we do in chemistry to avoid these sort of problems is, rather than using water, we use an organic solvent. So things like, you know, chloroform or acetone, what have we got up there? Probably ethanol, all sorts of different organic solutions that we would use when building a complex molecule rather than water. Because if it's being linked by a dehydration reaction, water is the last thing you want to use when building a large molecule. Okay, so I thought of a cooking analogy for all of this. It's really trying to make a complex molecule like DNA in the presence of water is about as silly as trying to make chicken soup from a beef stock. You wouldn't do it. It's the wrong liquid. It's the wrong solvent. You'd use a chicken stock to make a chicken noodle soup. So trying to expect these complex molecules to assemble in a water environment is really a very silly thing to do. It's not going to happen. Okay, so another reason why atheism is implausible: there's no supernatural being with the intelligence to choose the right reaction conditions or solvents needed to make a DNA molecule. Now, third problem is what we might call the bad connections problems. This is that during monomer assembly and polymer synthesis, lots of incorrect linkage reactions occur. Now, remember I said that a deoxynucleotide represents a very precise configuration where an adenine is attached via one particular site to a sugar and then a phosphate is attached at the other end of the sugar. If we just took a pure source of adenine and a pure source of deoxyribose and tossed in some phosphate and cooked it up in a test tube, we would get some of that being formed, but we'd also get all sorts of other inappropriate linkages occurring. Okay, so you can see what's happening here. The adenine's attaching to the wrong place on the sugar, the phosphate's attaching to the wrong place. And there are infinite numbers of possibilities almost. Well, not infinite, but large numbers of inappropriate combinations. And so even though this one might be formed in small quantities, there'll be a lot of others formed inappropriately. And people have done the calculation that just to make a single dinucleotide, so this is the tiniest polymer of DNA possible, where we've just got two deoxynucleotides attached to each other, so, and these are both the same deoxynucleotide, a deoxyadenosine with an adenine base there, there are 2,160 possibilities, including the right one, and 2,159 wrong combinations. Only one of them is present in DNA. So if you're relying on a blind, unguided chemical reaction to occur, then most of the time you're going to get very inappropriate combinations and linkages forming, and only a very tiny proportion of the time the appropriate molecule being formed. Okay, so that's no way to make DNA. Now, if you go on and do chemistry is a fantastic science, organic chemistry, and organic chemists spend their careers trying to think of really cool ways to devise new molecules. I work in the pharmaceutical sciences, and chemists devise brilliant strategies for building complex drugs. They do it all the time. And they do so because they use things called protecting groups. And a protecting group, just simply, you can put it on a molecule and block all these potential sites of reactivity and just leave the one free that you want to where you want the reaction to go. So in this case, we've got a protected adenine and a protected sugar. And so now we're controlling the chemistry so that the sugar and the adenine only link via that bond that we really want to form, because that's the one that occurs in nature. And then we do a thing called a deprotection, where we often treat with an acid, a mild acid or something, to strip off the deprotection groups, or the protecting groups, and we now have the molecule of interest. So this is a very sophisticated and advanced science. Chemists are very good at doing these intelligent syntheses of complex molecules. But of course, on the early Earth, there's no intelligence, is there? There's no one controlling the chemistry. So that's one of the problems with atheism. There's no supernatural being with the brains to prevent unproductive side reactions that don't make DNA. Now, another problem I think will be one we can all relate to, especially in this camp, of course. We've all got this rule: before we go out in the sun in an activity, we very wisely put sunscreen all over us. And that's because the DNA in your skin cells is very vulnerable to ultraviolet radiation. Every, I think it's second, there's something like 1,000 thymidine dimers form in an exposed, sun-exposed skin cell. So thymidine dimers form when you get damage to genetic material, and two thymines react to each other, and they can cause mutations and drive cancer development. So that's why we slop sunscreen to block the exposure of DNA in our skin cells to UV. But this raises a problem, doesn't it, for chemical evolution? Because you see, Miller and Urey, they set up their experiment and then started bombarding it with all this oxygen to get all this energy to get the molecules to react with each other. But no one's controlling, in the early Earth, there's no one there to control the input of energy. There's no one to turn off the switch on the electrical discharge system when the DNA is formed. And we're just continually blasting with whatever energy source we're using. And that same energy can destroy DNA and break it down. Okay, so this is a real problem with naturalistic theories of life's origin, that the uncontrolled energy sources needed to drive the production of DNA tend ultimately to destroy it. Now, this is just a reality of living in the world that we do. We all know about polymers being damaged by ultraviolet radiation, and if you're very wise, you'll always use an exterior paint if you're painting your front porch or your front fence, because exterior paints are loaded up with UV stabilizers and interior paints aren't. And those stabilizers there are to absorb all that damaging ultraviolet and protect the polymers in the paint so that they continue to protect your woodwork. So what happens, we don't have any UV protection in an early Earth, do we? We have these bases, particularly guanine, but some of the others as well. Guanine and adenine are most vulnerable, but DNA with this uncontrolled, unrelenting exposure to energy from the sun, this damaging ultraviolet radiation, can destroy the DNA as quickly as it's formed. And again, we know this from cooking, don't we? I mean, you know, my wife does a lot of cooking, and let's imagine she wants to make a cake for church in the morning, take it for morning tea. So she thinks, I'll make it Saturday night and I'll just put it in the oven, I'll go to bed and leave it in there overnight and I'll just take it to church in the morning. You can't do that. You put a cake in the oven, you've got to watch it, bring it out within a few minutes of the 40 minutes or 60 minutes that the recipe specifies to bake a cake. You can't just leave it in there for hours. But you see, this is what we're doing. There's no chef in Darwinism's kitchen. And so successful outcomes in the kitchen require careful attention to the right cooking time. Otherwise, we get something like a charred mass. So that's another problem with this atheist worldview, that there's no supernatural being with the brains to take the soup pot off the stove. That is, to limit exposure of DNA to some of these very destructive energy sources that you need to get the chemistry going, but you need to also limit them if you're going to get meaningful reactions occurring. Now, this is my final example. I'm going a bit long here. This is another really damaging problem with what we call these abiogenesis theories, these early Earth simulations. We might call it the missing metabolic intermediate problem. And this arises because cells make the building blocks for DNA via complex multi-step processes. Few of the essential reaction intermediates form under earlier simulation conditions. Well, what do I mean here? This is an example that's often given in textbooks, evolutionary textbooks. They'll tell us that what happened on the early Earth is that we got these early cells that formed, and they were immersed in this chemical soup which contained our adenine and our sugars and our phosphate, and they made their way into the cell, and we got all this chemistry occurring to make the deoxynucleotides, and with time all these ingredients in the chemical soup were drawn upon to make new molecules that eventually gave rise to what became DNA. But you can see, as all these molecules are being made, they're being consumed outside the cell, right? So they're disappearing because they're being used up by the cell as a result of early metabolic reactions occurring within those early primitive cells, making DNA. So what happens when all those reagents are used up? Sooner or later, primitive cells ran out of those external sources and they had to start making their own building blocks. So how do evolutionary-minded people explain this phenomenon? Well, the naturalistic solution is that they say, well, what must have happened is that, let's take the case of adenine. Okay, so adenine's being used in the manufacture of DNA. It's all used up in the chemical soup. So what must have happened is that there must have been some other chemical in the soup, and we'll call it compound Z, where it could be converted to adenine by some enzyme which must have evolved to meet that need, to convert Z to A. And then with time, Z was all used up, so another enzyme evolved which could convert Y, another chemical in the mixture, into compound Z to maintain supplies of adenine, and so on. And so perhaps these enzymes evolved that were able to convert all these different chemicals, V, W, Y, and Z, floating around in the chemical soup, convert each of them into the so-called precursors that are used to make adenine. And that sounds nice, doesn't it? You read that in a lot of biology textbooks, and they'll say this is how biochemical pathways originated, that we all learn about in biochemistry, you know, glycolysis and the TCA cycle, all that stuff. This is how they say it likely originated. Enzymes evolved that were able to convert pre-existing chemical soup constituents into desirable products. The question is, how feasible is this? So let's look at a case of adenine. And in a modern cell, there are actually 13 enzymes. It's a 14-step process converting all these pre-existing precursors into adenine. Okay, 13 enzymes. And 13 metabolic precursors, that is, chemicals that are converted ultimately into adenine as a result of going through these biochemical processes. Now, would anyone like to hazard a guess how many of these 13 metabolic precursors for adenine have been detected in an early Earth simulation? None. Yeah, you're right. The answer, big fat zero. None of compounds 1 to 13 are detected in early Earth simulations. So this is almost a devastating problem with abiogenesis theory. Okay, so can you see now why no one's got a Nobel Prize in this field? It's like, yeah, it sounds great, and it's great to put it in textbooks, photos of Miller's experiments, and to excite people, but to actually ask decent scientific questions about the feasibility of it all starts to look very shocking. Okay, so just to draw the final conclusion from that particular problem, to avoid running out of key ingredients, cooks need a well-stocked pantry. And I've already mentioned my wife. My wife's from a sort of dietetics food science background, and I was amazed when I got married because she needed this great big pantry. I used to cope with just a few little ingredients for my very limited repertoire, bachelor's repertoire cooking. I could make a few things and that was it. I didn't need much of a pantry. When I married my wife, she makes all sorts of stuff. It has to be well stocked. And that's the problem, isn't it? There's no one with the brains maintaining reserves of building blocks needed to produce DNA in a universe without a God. So remember how we started off by saying that Professor Dickerson said that science is a game, trying to explain nature without the existence of God. I don't know what you think about that, but I think game over, really. I mean, I can see why Alexander Flew came to the conclusion he did, why one of the great atheists of the 20th century changed his mind, because he realised he couldn't envisage appropriate naturalistic explanations for the existence of DNA. Okay. And I thought I'd just throw in this little quotation too from Francis Crick. I think he's still alive, but he made this remarkable observation in one of his books. And this is back in 1981, before the really big explosion in genetics and molecular biology occurred. He's just at the beginning of it, really, in 1981. And he says, "An honest man armed with all the knowledge available to us now could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions it would have had to get satisfied to get it along." So a nice moment of honesty there from the guy who made one of the great scientific discoveries in the history of science. He's a committed atheist, but he's admitting there that he struggles to explain where these remarkable living systems came from. Okay, so let's close up now by summarising. What can we learn from DNA? It's a very complex molecule, and it has to be complex because it has to be able to store all that amazing biological information needed to create a new you. And just as you're very different from your brother or your sister, all that difference has to be encoded in your genome. So it has to be a complex molecule. We've seen that random, undirected physical processes struggle to produce even tiny pieces of DNA. So it's pretty unlikely that this molecule arose without the input of a creator, from my view. So DNA shows all the signs of external agency, and I think Anthony Flew came to that view, that an external agent must have interfered in the creation of life, a divine being. And just to close now, I thought I'd close with one of history's great ironies. Because remember I said that Watson and Crick did their research in a particular laboratory in the British Isles. They did it in this laboratory known as the Cavendish Lab. Now, Cavendish Lab's actually the Department of Physics at the University of Cambridge. It's one of the great scientific institutions in the world. Something like 35, I think, Nobel Prizes in physics have come from that one laboratory. It's amazing. But what people don't appreciate is that every day when Watson and Crick walked into their laboratory, and both of them are atheists, they would have passed under a plaque at the entrance to that laboratory. One of the great verses in the book of Psalms, from my view: "The works of the Lord are great, sought out are all of them, sought out of all of them that have pleasure therein." What a beautiful verse that is. The works of God are great. And what a fitting epitaph, really, to one of the greatest discoveries in the history of science, even though they didn't recognise the creator. That there, and this is written in Latin in the Cavendish laboratory, so perhaps they didn't know what it meant, but a testimony to the conviction that the world we live in is a creation of a divine being. Who put it there? Well, I think it's probably the man who was the first appointee, the first professor of physics at Cavendish, James Clerk Maxwell. And as Presbyterians, we should remember that name because he was a Presbyterian Christian from Scotland, and he was appointed at Cambridge, I think, in around about the middle of the 18th century. He made some of the greatest discoveries in physics that allowed the whole electronics revolution to occur. Every time you use your mobile phone or your laptop, say thank you for the life of James Clerk Maxwell. He was a very committed Christian, Presbyterian. He memorised the entire book of Psalms. Pretty amazing. So he wasn't a minimal Christian. He loved the Word of God and he loved the faith. But he prayed this on one occasion. He says, "Teach us to study the works of thy hands, that we may subdue the earth to our use and strengthen our reason for thy service." So that's a different motivation for science than the modern guys work with, that naturalistic assumption that just makes science a game, trying to explain the world without God. I think Professor Maxwell gives us a much more stable basis for science and society. Okay, I'm out of puff. I'm sorry I've gone so long, but if we've got time for... anyone got any quick questions?